Hurricanes seem to be getting stronger and more destructive. How much does that have to do with climate change? Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Dr. Tim Hall is a NASA researcher who's going to be talking in South Florida today. He says there is a correlation between the two. We'll talk with him about the latest research. Plus, a new report from the Southern Poverty Law Center shows that there still remain hundreds of Confederate symbols and names in public spaces. There are dozens across the state of Florida, but many have been removed from our region in the past year. We'll speak with a lead researcher about the recent changes. And on the two-year anniversary of the Pulse nightclub shooting, we'll hear about a special comedy event that pays tribute with LGBTQ performers. All of that today on Sundial. First, the news. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Thanks so much for joining us. So what do the future of hurricanes look like? We saw the devastation caused by Hurricane Irma, Maria, and Harvey in the Keys, Puerto Rico, and Houston. And research by NASA scientists shows that, well, they're getting worse. Dr. Tim Hall has been studying extreme weather events for years and their growing intensity linked to climate change. He's a senior research scientist with NASA and an adjunct professor at Columbia University. Hall is going to be speaking at the CIC co-working space in Wynwood tonight at 6 o'clock in an event put on by the Miami Climate Alliance. And he joins us now in studio. Dr. Hall, Tim, thank you so much for joining us. I appreciate it.
Thanks for having me, Luis. It's a pleasure to be here.
So you've been conducting this research on climate change and extreme storm events for years now. But what evidence do we have that change in climate is leading to hurricanes getting worse?
I like to order the relationship between hurricanes and climate in terms of what we know with the most degree of certainty and what maybe is possibly alarming, but we don't know quite as well. And one of the things that's related to hurricane hazard, it's really quite certain. The most robust projection of a changing climate is sea level rise. I mean, simply put, warmer seawater takes up more volume, so the water rises as the oceans warm. And even if hurricanes weren't changing in intensity, which we'll probably talk about, and they are, but even if they weren't, the same winds blowing over a higher baseline will just push water deeper into land, and you get worse flooding events.
So we see if the water is rising and it's also warming, and warm water is part of the fuel for hurricanes.
Yes, absolutely, yeah.
So,
yeah.
You know, that in of itself we see. But do we see hurricanes, getting bigger? They are stronger, more rain events? I mean, what's happening?
You're right at it. Those are elements 2 and 3 in my sort of hierarchy of what we know best. The second being rain events. Warmer air holds more water in the vapor form. And so when the conditions are right, as they are in a mature hurricane, that water is available to rain. Even aside from hurricanes, the amount of rain that's falling in fewer but more intense events across the U.S. and, in fact, across the world is increasing. So we're really getting in a situation where we're getting – some places it's getting wetter, some places it's getting drier. But everywhere, when it rains in less frequent but more intense events. And that's actually worse for flooding. You know, it doesn't give the land time to absorb the rainfall, and it just runs off in flooding.
How would you describe the level of research that's being done right now to better understand this correlation? I mean, how many different groups, countries are doing this research?
Sure. This is a quite active area of climate change research. So there are hundreds of scientists working on, you know, the question of hurricanes and climate and extreme weather and climate, and not just public sector government labs, university researchers, absolutely, but there are private sector companies that have a lot of skin in the game, say insurance and reinsurance companies and the various private sector modeling companies that feed into that industry. And they all have teams and teams of people working on this and around the world.
So when we look at, let's say if we looked at the last 100 years of storms or, you know, whatever we have recorded that we can point to, can you say at one point you started to see storms growing or changing in some way, maybe the number of storms, the intensification of the storms? Is there some point you could say, look, here's where we start to see the shift. Can we link it to what we've seen in the changing climate?
I mean, it's hard. It's a hard problem because, by definition, an intense storm is a rare event. So you're looking at the changing frequency of rare events, and you need to sort of accumulate enough events to see a trend in that. But now the signal is pretty clearly popping through the noise. You can look in several, you know, of the major hurricane breeding grounds around the world, and we're seeing that there's not necessarily a change in the frequency of the storms, but there's a change in the fraction that are reaching the highest levels of intensity.
Getting up to Category 5.
Exactly, yeah. 3, 4, 5, what we call major hurricanes. And possibly down the road in categories, well, not categories, but at levels we've never seen before historically.
And that goes back to looking at, you know, the wind speed, the flooding, and all of these other aspects of what a storm is. And you're seeing these things get worse.
Yes. So there's several aspects that go into the hazard of a hurricane. One is just the direct wind, and that's the hazard by blowing down structures, say. Another, and then there's the flooding, which can be driven either by the surge, which is the mountain of water the wind pushing over the ocean drives towards the coastline. And then, of course, the rainfall. And both of those things contribute to flooding. All three of those things are increasing. The surge hazard is increasing because of sea level rise, primarily. The rain hazard is increasing because there's moister air and warmer air, and so there's more moisture available for rainfall. And the wind hazard is increasing because warmer seas are essentially the fuel for hurricanes. It's a little more complicated than that. There's some T's to cross and I's to dot. But basically, warmer seawater is the fuel for hurricanes, and that drives stronger hurricanes as the oceans warm.
When you look at last year, Harvey, Irma, Maria, you look at those storms, do they show you any of these things that you're discussing? Was there anything unique about those storms that you say, wow, we're seeing this?
Well, there was a lot unique about 2017. It was, you know, a season for the record books for sure. And you can talk about Irma, Harvey, and Maria. In fact, other storms too. I mean, people don't, it doesn't get as much attention, but Hurricane Ophelia actually hit Ireland, which is almost unprecedented in the well-documented historic record. But let's get to the major ones, Irma, Harvey, and Maria. Those three storms, in terms of dollar losses, were the three biggest dollar losses in the U.S. And three in the top five in the historic record. Harvey was only behind Katrina. Harvey is a great example of our ability to see a climate change signal in its rainfall. There have been recent studies that can directly relate the amount of rain in Harvey to the increasing warmth in the Gulf. And if you trace back the energy equation from rainfall to condensation to evaporation to heat in the Gulf waters, you find that about a third of Harvey's rainfall is related to the warming Gulf in the past several decades.
Something else I had read, too, is that one of the other things, especially I think with Harvey, is that one, it moved a little bit further north, was more powerful as it moved north than many storms in the past. But also is the fact that storms now seem to be, as they go into the Gulf, kind of get stuck there sometimes. Then they just grow.
That's a great point. And that gets to another relationship between climate and hurricanes that maybe is a little bit less uncertain, but very interesting and possibly alarming. And that is that the possibility of changes in hurricane trajectories, their paths, and the possibility of more meandering storms, storms that take oddball left-hand turns or right turns or just stall out like Harvey did. I mean, basically, Harvey just stalled over just off the Texas coast for several days, not moving very much at high intensity, and acted as a conveyor belt, dumping warm Gulf waters right onto Houston. And so there have been recent studies that suggest that this is a pattern related to the changing global circulation of the planet as the climate warms, and that it's resulting in slower, more meandering hurricane tracks and generally slower moving hurricanes, not less intense. I mean, how they translate more slowly. That is more hazardous because if you just think about surge, for example, you just have a longer period of time where the hurricane winds are blowing water toward the coast, or a longer period of time where it's, you know, dumping seawater onto an adjacent city in terms of rain.
We also saw this year a tropical system that formed actually the week before hurricane season started.
Alberto.
And we've seen in the past that was actually going back into the early mid-aughts. We saw storms that all of a sudden were coming in December at one point. You know, we know hurricane season doesn't have to fit the calendar, right. But we set the calendar because that's usually when they happen. What are we seeing in the shift of hurricanes coming earlier, staying later?
Yeah, so Alberto is unusual because it happened, before the season started in May. It's not unprecedented. There have been a few storms, named storms in May, and also past the end of the season in December. But, you know, as the oceans warm, the geographic extent of the region that's warm enough to sustain a hurricane and also the time extent in the season expands. So there's a good reason to believe that you would have a longer hurricane season and also a hurricane climatology that would push further and further north, the possibility of having higher intensity hurricanes, you know, at mid-latitudes.
We are talking with Dr. Tim Hall. He's been studying extreme weather events for years. They're growing, especially hurricanes, they're growing intensity due to climate change. He's a senior research scientist with NASA and an adjunct professor at Columbia University. As mentioned before, he is going to be speaking tonight at the CIC co-working space in Wynwood. That's at 6 o'clock. This is an event put on by Miami Climate Alliance. Tim, you work with reinsurance companies on evaluating risk assessments because of hurricanes and extreme storm events. How has their calculus changed as a result of these growing storms?
Yeah, I mean, reinsurance companies have skin in the game, right? So they follow this stuff. They fund some of the research. They have their own in-house research teams. They hire research from private sector modeling companies whose expertise is catastrophe risk analysis. And, you know, they know that their ability to survive as a company down the road depends on their ability to project the risk and to adjust their portfolios and to pick and choose, you know, what type of properties they want to insure. And so they're aware of it. Their contracts typically renew annually, so some of the things they can do are decide, you know, which types of contracts they want to pursue down the road if they think that, you know, certain portfolios are too risky now in a warming climate with increased sea level.
So your experience, I mean, insurance companies, there's no debate with them on the issue of climate change and, you know, how we see changes in weather events. Because
No
debate with them. Did any of them express concerns over sea level risk, the increased asset exposure to the flooding that we see here, especially in South Florida?
Yeah, that's a good point. I mean, when you talk about changes in hurricane hazard, like the meteorology of hurricanes and climate, we really have to step back a minute and say, well, why is it that that there are increased dollar losses? Well, primarily it's because there's increased exposure. There's more stuff in harm's way, expensive stuff in harm's way. You know, we've had some zoning, you know, changes in zoning regulations, so we have better structures that can withstand hurricane wind better and maybe flooding also. But there's definitely more stuff in harm's way.
Interesting. As you said, you know, a lot of these contracts renew annually. Yeah. So trying to project way in the future. But, I mean, I've heard about, you know, banks thinking about at some point in South Florida anyway, they may stop giving out 25, 30-year mortgages because some areas are at great risk. But with insurance companies, with these groups that you've dealt with anyway, how are they looking at the far future? How are they looking 15, 20, 30 years down the road?
Well, I wish I could say for sure that, you know, a company looks, you know, 20 or 30 years down the road. I'm not really sure that time horizon is, you know, front and center for much of any company, unfortunately. But a company that's been around many decades, of course, wants to try to ensure that it will be around a decade or two more. Many of these companies are mature, sober companies that have been in the business for quite a while. So, they will adjust their portfolios and what type of, you know, contracts they want to issue, you know, according to the risk they see. And then they actually, some of their R&D teams are staffed with atmospheric scientists and people who have been trained academically in the subject. So,
There was controversy surrounding President Trump's nomination of Jim Bernstein. He had previously expressed doubts that humans were a cause of climate change. Has his position changed?
His position has changed, actually. And You know, and I think, you know, he deserves credit for that. Yes, it's true. Bridenstine was a congressman from Oklahoma, and in the past he had expressed some pretty strong skepticism about the science of climate change. And
by the way, I didn't mention he's head of NASA, so that's why.
Yeah, now he's head of NASA. Yeah. Now he's just been appointed as the administrator for NASA. And as recently as a month or two ago, he was giving a town hall meeting where he said, absolutely, you know, humans play a major role in a climate that is definitely changing. So and I think that was, you know, listening to the NASA scientists and other government scientists and reading, you know, government documents that make the case very strongly and nearly irrefutably. So I'm heartened to see that, you know, he's responded to that.
And President Trump's new budget had cut funding to the EPA and a lot of funding to climate change programs. With those kind of cuts, what do we lose?
We lose research missions. We lose satellites in space. That and some of the best ways to see an evolving climate is to look at it from above. You know, we lose scientists to the private sector who may not do that kind of research anymore.
Is there a threat to any cuts to NASA's research in this area?
NASA's budget has been pretty flat for many years. And, you know, the partitioning between space science and earth science, you know, goes up and down. But there has not been a strong shift, no.
And you know, coming back to Mr. Bridenstine, you know, how's he looking at hurricanes now, especially with this upcoming season? What's he looking at? What's he thinking about?
I've never met him, so I don't know what he's thinking about exactly. I know that he's always been an enthusiast for weather forecasting, and NASA plays some role in there, although NOAA plays a bigger role. But NASA has satellites that are used for weather forecasting purposes. So I hope he's following the season. And so, you know, he's paying attention to particular storms and the particular hazard of a particular season. But also he's, you know, listening to his scientists who are telling him that there is a trend here and it's alarming.
What about you? What's on your horizon? What do you, you know, where's the research going?
I think the attribution studies are very interesting. These are studies where we can look at particular extreme events like Harvey, Maria, Irma, and we can start to say, yes, this was due to a changing climate. You know, 40% of the storm's damage we can attribute to a changing climate, for example. It used to be just as recently as a decade ago when people would ask us, is some particular extreme event due to climate change? And we would sort of hem and haw and say, well, you can never attribute any particular event to climate change, but, and now we simply say yes. And we say yes because the signal is popping out of the noise, but we also say yes because we've developed new tools, modeling tools, increased computer capability and better observations that allow us to, you know, decompose an extreme event to a part that we can assign to climate change and a part that might have been consistent with just natural variation.
You personally, what do you think we're going to be experiencing in the coming decades? What do you think is going to happen?
You know, it's not a matter of my personal opinion. It's a matter of, you know,
well,
the results.
The
yes.
Yeah.
For instance, increased frequency of what people in Florida already see, what we call nuisance flooding, basically clear sky, no storm. You know, it's high tide. The ocean currents have some sort of chaotic variability. But with a higher baseline from sea level rise, suddenly, you know, you're getting flooding on your street of a foot or two, you know, six times a year. And that only, and you know, a few decades ago, that was only once a year. I mean, that's just nuisance flooding. It's not life-threatening, but it's damaging. But then, you know, we will see, you know, $100 billion events and, you know, insured and uninsured loss events that, you know, were previously thought to be, you know, once a century or less frequent happening every few decades, you know, and that's not sustainable, you know. I mean, a couple hundred billion here, a couple hundred billion there, pretty soon you're talking real money, right? And we will have to, look, we can mitigate by, you know, trying to bend the warming curve down a bit by, you know, increasing reliance on renewables. That's important. But we'll also have to adapt because even if we stopped emitting greenhouse gases tomorrow, the oceans would go on warming for a couple of decades. That's an important point. So there's definitely going to be adaptation. So those two things are a combination that we should be doing. On the other hand, we can just do nothing and just suffer. But, you know, at some point after an event like Harvey, you know, which on a non-climate warming baseline, you know, might be like a 10,000-year event. It's never been seen, 60 inches of rain in a station in Houston. At some point when that happens, you know, every couple of decades, you know, if there's no planning and no infrastructure put in place, people will just retreat from the coasts.
We've been talking with Dr. Tim Hall. He's a senior research scientist with NASA. He's an adjunct professor at Columbia University. He's speaking again tonight at CIC Co-Working Space in Wynwood. That's at 6 o'clock. It's an event put on by Miami Climate Alliance. Dr. Hall, it's been a pleasure, man. Thank you so much.
Thanks so much. It's been a pleasure, too.
Still to come, there are hundreds of Confederate symbols across the country. What should happen to them? More on that coming up on Sundial here on WLRN. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. Well, 3 years after the Charleston church shooting, more than 100 monuments and other symbols of the Confederacy across the South have been removed. 9 have been removed in Florida, but a total of 65 Confederate symbols still remain in this state. These are monuments, street names, buildings, county names, and holidays. The Southern Poverty Law Center released a report called Whose Heritage, identifying that nationwide, there are still more than 1,700 publicly supported monuments and other tributes to the Confederacy. The fervor over the removal of these symbols has waned, but the question remains, should all symbols related to the Confederacy be taken down? Keegan Hainkes is Senior Research Analyst with the Southern Poverty Law Center, and he joins us now via Skype to talk about the study's key findings, especially looking at what happened here in Florida. Mr. Hainkes, thank you so much for your time today.
Hey, thanks for having me. It's a pleasure.
So the story of removing or not removing these symbols hasn't really been in the national spotlight for some time. Does that concern you?
Well, it does. And I think, you know, one of the things that this study shows us is just how pervasive these symbols still are in life, particularly in the South. You know, the study found 1,700 of them, and it really shows the pervasiveness of these ideas and the memory of the Confederacy that's still being tacitly supported on public land every day in people's everyday lives.
Now we see that we've had 9 symbols removed in Florida since the Charleston attack. Can you remind us of some of those?
Yeah, sure. So particularly in the Miami area, there were a series of streets named after Confederate generals that were taken down. You also had several statues and monuments that were taken down. One was in Gainesville. Another one was in Bradenton. And there's also been a school renamed. That was a little bit earlier, but it took place in 1989, and that was an elementary school in Park named after Robert E. Lee in Miami.
So you still have significant number of dozens of symbols in Florida, but what are some of the bigger ones, at least, that most concern you?
Well, I mean, anything that's going to support a leader of the Confederate forces, right, who was an outspoken white supremacist or fighting to uphold the institution of slavery. You see a lot of these. Robert E. Lee is one of the most pervasive. This is one of those outspoken white supremacists and slaveholders I mentioned. You even see individuals like Nathan Bedford Forrest, who was once a Grand Wizard of the Ku Klux Klan, immortalized.
We have, and the report showed there are 5 counties in the state of Florida that have Confederate names named after Confederate leaders. Lee is one of them. Pasco, Henry, Baker, Bradford. Changing the name of a county is a bit trickier. Do you think, though, they should try to do that?
I think it would be productive. And a county is a good example of one of the points we make in the study, which is that context is often what's lost when you immortalize these figures and emblazon their names in public places, but offer no explanation for why they're there. You know, we find that that is one of the largest problems, is that these individuals are held up, and for many people, they are a reminder that a war was fought in many cases to keep them enslaved.
Now, a lot of the symbols, and I mean, I don't have a number, and you might have a closer idea, but a lot of the Confederate symbols did not go up right after the Civil War. And actually, in your report, you look at 2 periods in American history when we really saw these symbols start to, these statues and many of these other things start to pop up, really. What were those two moments?
Well, I'm glad you bring this up, because this is a common misconception. You know, the 2 large spikes in when these monuments were erected were in the beginning of the 20th century, and this was right around the time that Jim Crow laws were being enacted to disenfranchise African Americans. This was also around the time of a Klan revival. And the second is in the 1950s and 1960s, particularly around the Brown versus Board of Education decision and the Civil Rights Act of 1965. So it's our view that given these spikes and given when these monuments were put into many of these public places, that they are tangible physical reminders of who is still in charge.
Do you think those who believe these symbols should stay up because it's a part of their heritage, it's a part of history, we shouldn't take them down, you've heard those arguments. Do you think that any of them have any beliefs, racist beliefs, and that they're fighting for these symbols because of that?
Well, I think the most important question to ask here when you're addressing the heritage and hate argument is, whose heritage are we talking about? You know, overwhelmingly, these monuments and symbols and namesakes are for white men who fought the Confederacy. And who that ignores and erases in some way are all the other people who were affected by this conflict, including those who were enslaved at the time.
Now, you hear critics say that we're erasing history when we do that. What do you say to that?
I would say that these monuments have already erased history. You know, when you uphold these men and uphold relation to that, you know, the ideas that they fought for, again, you have already ignored a large part of history, including, I might add, you know, a large swell of abolition activity around that time period.
We're talking with Keegan Hainkes, senior researcher, research analyst with the Southern Poverty Law Center. He's joining us via Skype. We're talking about a new report that shows there are still more than 1,700 Confederate symbols in public spaces in this country, many of them, of course, in the South. The center has published a community guide, action guide. What's in it?
Well, you know, it's a guide for possible ways to organize and to draw support, and also maybe most importantly to address some of the myths and misunderstandings about these monuments. You know, it's made for a variety of communities, of course, because there's no single recipe for how to get this done. But we're trying to help individuals take action in their own local communities to affect the change that they want to see.
And I mean, the guide also shows people how they can take the lead on this, on this issue in their community, and how to go about trying to remove these symbols.
It does. And I think, you know, that starts first and foremost with research, which was one of the goals of this report, right? To be a public resource for people, a public source of information. And it's really important for people who find themselves living amongst these statues that in many cases are very offensive to them, to start there and to start understanding the history behind when and why these monuments were placed there. From there, you're able to start drumming up support and working towards the change you'd like to see in their community.
We go back to the report and we think about, first of all, the fact that, you know, for a period of more than a year, for many months, this was a story that was in the national spotlight. It was in the national news. And of course, in different places, we would see statues being taken down. And as I mentioned at the beginning, that's not a big discussion anymore, at least not nationally. It just depends on what community you're in. But one of the things that I find interesting is the fact that we'd never really had a discussion about, or we never heard about, how many of these symbols exist. This report had to find a way to really tally up how many are out there. How did you collect that information?
Well, we used a combination of resources. Some of them were public databases of landmarks, street names, and so on. Others were private. But I think most movingly, you know, after we released the first version of this report several years ago, we started to hear from community members from across the country telling us about monuments that we missed. And that really underscores, I think, the pervasiveness of these symbols in public life and just how embedded they are in the infrastructure. You know, many of these people didn't even know were in their community, and they wrote in to ask us to include them.
Do you think that you would have had a more full list if you didn't have that community outreach?
You know, I think the community outreach was a big deal, and I think it did contribute quite a bit to the second list. Yes.
In this report, there's a term used. It's called the lost cause myth. What does that mean?
Well, you know, it's a shorthand way to talk about the sanitization of the story of the Civil War that was pervasive for over 100 years. You know, it's this idea that the Civil War wasn't as ugly as it actually was and wasn't explicitly about upholding and protecting the institution of slavery, but was instead a war of Northern aggression, a war against the South's way of life, and a war about whether the South was going to be able to govern itself as it was. You know, it's part of a larger revisionist project of which these monuments and symbols are an extension.
How much did that lost cause myth drive this report, the new one?
Well, I think it's a huge driver, right? Because this is the whole impetus for creating this list as a public resource, is to show just how real this lost cause ideology is.
You know, we've seen a rise in at least the public-facing aspect of the white nationalist movement in the United States. How do these historic relics from the Confederacy play into modern racism and the nationalist movement we've seen?
Well, I think it's impossible for us to talk about, you know, why we undertook this report without remembering the tragedy in Charleston. You know, there was the original grassroots swell behind removing some of these public monuments and symbols from public land was when a photo emerged of Dylan Roof, the perpetrator of the Charleston massacre, holding a Confederate flag and a handgun. You know, I think we saw another version of this, another extreme version of this, last August in Charlottesville, where, you know, many people forget amidst the chaos and racism and violence that rally was explicitly about protecting the statue of Robert E. Lee in Charlottesville.
Have you ever seen in any other country symbols from a previous Civil War that are still standing?
Not to the extent that we see it in the United States. I mean, 1,700 is truly a staggering number. And I think it is a very different and unordinary way to handle public memory. You know, it's one thing if you have these monuments and symbols properly contextualized within a museum, or perhaps they're on private property, but to have them standing in the public square without context is unique.
Do you think that all of these symbols should come down? Do you think they will?
I don't think they will, particularly because there is still a push underfoot in many states, particularly in the South, to enact legislation that prevents them from being removed and prevents them from being obscured. But I do believe that they should be removed from public life. I think it is a tragedy that many people who are African American maybe have to go to a library or a post office or to pay a parking ticket and enter a building named for someone who fought to keep them enslaved.
Again, Keegan Hincus is a senior research analyst with the Southern Poverty Law Center. He was talking to us via Skype. We were talking about a new report from the center that shows that there are more than 1,700 Confederate symbols still in public spaces around the country, a lot of them, most of them in the South. Mr. Hincus, thank you so much for your time. Really appreciate it.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
All right, still to come, we're going to look a little bit closer at the comedy scene here in Miami through the LGBTQ community. That's all coming up next on Sundial here on WLRN. Hello, welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Well, 2 years ago, the shooting at Pulse Nightclub took the lives of 49 people and sent shockwaves through the LGBTQ community. It spurred activism in various forms across the country that continues to this day. The Yaz LGBTQ improv team is part of the Villain Theater here in Miami. The troupe is made up of improv actors and comics that identify as LGBTQ. 2 years ago, the troupe started a No Fear, We're Queer comedy night in response to the Pulse nightclub shooting. The event includes improv performances, a drag show, and a drag show, all a part of the Pride Month. In studio joining me now, Villain Theater co-founder Peter Min. Peter, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having us, Lewis.
Great to have you here. Yaz performer and theater community liaison Josh Hamilton. Thank you, Josh.
Thank you, Lewis.
And also joining us, a keynote midnight performer this weekend. She identifies as drag queen Miss Toto. Miss Toto, thank you so much.
Hi, thanks for having me.
I appreciate all of you being here. I'm going to throw this to all of you. I just want to hear, how did the No Fear We Are Queer event come to be? And really, what is the message that you're trying to send out to the community?
Well, the show itself was a direct response to the Pulse tragedy. And so with improv theater, we get to respond to things right away. Since we're unscripted, we can create a show in direct response to things that are happening in local events. So when that tragedy happened, we knew that because of our community of LGBT performers and our audience, that we wanted to do something and raise some money to give back. And since that event, we decided that every Pride Month that we'd be doing it. So this is actually our third time that we're going to be doing No Fear, We're Queer.
And Peter, just, you know, thinking about the fact that, I mean, it was 2 years ago on this day, you know, I just wanted to get from you and from everybody, you know, what are the thoughts that are still going through your head?
Well, this is an incredibly important time in American history in order to speak up for those who are being oppressed. And so the LGBT community is a natural one for a theater, but also specifically for villain theater, this is the LGBT community is part of our core. And so we think of it as not just something that's a lot of fun, because we will have a lot of fun on Sunday being able to do a comedy show, but something that is integral to what villain theater does, which is, you know, thinking about others and trying to create a community.
And Josh, you know, we know that Yaz is under the villain theater, but explain to us, first of all, what that is.
So
what Yaz is, not the villain theater.
So pronounce Yaz.
Yaz. Sorry.
It's okay. Thank you. So Yaz is it's an excellent explanation of joy. Like, it's a word that the LGBTQ community uses in moments of joy, and that's where the name really resonates and really comes from. Because the entire point of our team is symbolic. You know, we are we are in South Florida. South Florida is much more open to the queer community than most places. But we are still representing a group that is still marginalized. And we, as a comedy troupe, we are there to present a face to people that says, you know, yes, we are proud of who we are. We will not be pigeonholed in who we are, but we are going to make you laugh, and we might make you laugh at yourself, because we have done that before.
But is this Miami's only LGBTQ improv team?
This is Florida's only team, as far as we know, in the whole state. We have at the moment, we're actually in, we go through version numbers. So right now, we actually just added another member to our team, because we just had some new company members join. So now we are up to 11. And that's, so we basically make up 1/5 of Villain Theater's company at this point. And that's a large thing to say in the improv community in general.
Do any of you have any connection to any of the folks from Pulse? You know, anybody who was there, or just any family or friends who lived up in Orlando?
I did have a couple of friends that were actually performing that night, that were actually hiding when it happened. And so, you know, I'm not originally from Florida. I'm actually from North Carolina originally, but I've gotten to know so many of performers and drag queens and people here that it's impossible to not know someone or someone next to someone who wasn't touched by it. And it resonates in everything that happens.
Ms. Toto, what about you? What connections do you have to Pulse?
With Pulse, there were so many people just being a performer in Florida that as soon as you found out it happened, you got chills through your spine. You're like, well, do I know anybody who was there? Because you had to. Everybody worked at that club. Every queen in Florida has been through that club. Anyone in Orlando works at that club. So you had to know somebody either at the club as a performer or just as an attendee or a patron. So it was actually really horrifying, because then it not only affected Orlando, but it affected everybody who goes out to clubs, performs in clubs, because then it makes you really question and value your safety in these spaces that are meant to be safe spaces for the LGBT and queer community.
Has anything changed in 2 years? Do you still worry about that safety?
I tend to not. Like, as soon as it happened, I'm like, I can't go anywhere. And that makes it really uncomfortable. But then as time has progressed, I've noticed, I mean, ramping up in security at all the venues, which has been really cool. But then also there are so many spaces where people make you feel safe, which it has its positives and negatives. But I'm saying in the grand scheme of things, you feel comfortable in these spaces, which that's the whole point. So in the past 2 years, I've seen a major change in how everyone also interacts with each other. It seems more special, more tight-knit, more close, because you really value each other a lot more.
When you think about comedy, this is always a tricky question, you know, is dealing with tragedy. And you think about comedy, how do you still perform? How do you bring comedy into tragedy? This is fine line you're walking, because you don't want to upset people. You don't want to say anything really wrong. But comedy can also help at the same time. Peter, what do you think? How do you mix the two?
I think that's what comedy is here for. I think everyone who comes to see our show, whether it's connected to this type of event or any event, you're looking for a distraction. I think people are getting more into fantasy and theater because of what's going on in the world right now. People want an escape, and that's the job of a comedian, I think, always. It's not just the skill of being funny. It's also setting people at ease, letting them know that they're taken care of, that they're there to have a good time, not just watching the show, but in their chair, at the bar, you know, interacting.
Do you talk about the tragedy, or do you want a total distraction from it altogether?
Well, I think that we will mention it, well, we certainly will mention it this Sunday during the show, because we'll be talking about, you know, how this thing got started. But really, this is a celebration of the kind of the growth of LGBT community and what we can do in going forward.
And real quickly, Josh wanted to ask you, after the first No Fear We're Queer comedy night, and again, this is directly after the Pulse shooting, what was the response from the community?
The response was, it was super positive. I mean, people, they need a light in the darkness, and for the most part, the queer community everywhere, we only have finite resources, you know? There's not a lot of television to turn to. There's not a lot of places where you can see yourself portraying that. And for a lot of people, it brought light to not just, you know, happiness and joy and something that you can find hope in afterward, but it also brought into aspect that even in our theater, like that is a safe space now. You know, we even though our theater is majority, you know, straight, anyone can come to our theater. Anyone that identifies as anything can come to our theater. They have a safe space. They have a home. They'll get a hug. They'll get a conversation. They'll make a friend. And I think that's something that has grown out of that. And as Ms. Toto was alluding to, is we are starting to build something that is more relevant and more tangible than just, you know, shouting at each other at a nightclub over loud music. Because that's oftentimes, that's the only aspect of life that a lot of queer people have. And that's one reason why, you know, we're so happy that, you know, at our theater that we do a show every Friday. You know that you can come every Friday and you can see us and you can see people just like you who are doing and playing so many different types of people, you know, that we often get pigeonholed and put into corners as to like, oh, well, you know, you identify as this, so you're going to play this. And I can in one night play 16 to 20 different characters just over the course of a show. And it's a way of telling everyone that we aren't cookie cutter. We aren't all the same. And that's a beautiful thing. And I think that's one thing that Pulse did bring to light in everything, is that we all need to value and cherish the time that we have, because you don't ever know really when your time is up.
We're talking with Villain Theater co-founder Peter Min, and I'm saying this right. Yas.
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 Extend the yas.
Thank you.
Think of it with three A's.
And yas. Four S's.
I'll get it.
And there's more letters get added as you keep saying.
You also heard, yeah, we're also talking with Josh Hamilton, improv member, and drag queen Miss Toto. They'll all play a part in hosting the theater's third annual No Fear We're Queer comedy show for Pride Month. Which, again, as we've been talking about, it started after the Pulse nightclub shootings in 2016. Miss Toto,
yes.
Talk about your style of performance and comedy. I mean, what are the qualities that you bring to the show? What do you do?
Well, for me, drag and hosting and performing just comes very naturally. So people think that, like, it's a character, which I guess it's developed, but it's literally me just talking on a microphone. And it feels like I want people to feel like they're talking directly to me. Even though I'm talking to a crowd of like 50, 60, 100 people, like I want it to feel like I'm speaking directly to you. And that makes the connection stronger, because when you're feeling like you're connecting to the audience and the audience is really connecting to you, it makes them want to engage more. They're into the theater, they're into the show. And as far as comedy, like I generally don't think I'm that funny.
You are.
But I don't think I'm that funny, but I just talk off what I'm feeling and picking up on different things from the audience, because you always have like certain people there who it's like it's their first drag show and they don't know what they're even looking at, because I look like a scary drag monster.
And anybody who's okay, so anybody who's never been to a drag show, I mean, what do you tell them about what that experience is going to be and what to expect?
I always tell them, like, you need to have fun. It's a drag show. Like, you're going to see some entertaining stuff. You're going to see stuff that you might really love. You might see some stuff you don't like, because you don't have to like everything. But also respect the performers. Don't text during the numbers. If you like what we're doing, you can definitely clap. And if you really like what we're doing, you can definitely tip, because drag is not cheap. So I just try to give everyone like a general rundown of like, here are some drag tips. Since this is your first drag show, you may not know what to do, like a drag 101, a pamphlet. But it's really cool because you see, even at Villain, and you see the community and the crowd understand, and they get it and they grow. And then you'll bring in different performers, and that gets a different crowd coming into Villain, and then they get to experience the whole improv community, which it's really cool getting to bring people into that so they can understand that that's an option.
And when you talk about, you know, giving, I guess, that guide to say, you know, what to expect, how do you describe the drag culture here in Miami and how it's changed over the years?
When I first started, it was very pageant, and all the queens are like gorgeous and gems and jewels and padding and body and hair. And it was like, this is something that I could never even imagine myself doing, because they're just so unreachable and gorgeous, and it's just on another level. And then in the past couple of years, like, the queer scene has really blown up, and it's been a lot of like hairy, bearded, like different. It's just so much, I'm not gonna say more entertaining, but it's also just very different. So for me, it feels very fresh. Like, it is very new, but we're looking at it from a different perspective of drag. So drag doesn't have to be pigeonholed into dressing like a girl or impersonating a female.
Does that mean that there's a clash? Because maybe you still have folks who are still doing it like they used to.
Of course. Well, you're always going to have those people who are like, well, what you're doing isn't drag. Or trying to put drag in a box. But what I've also noticed about the Miami scene is there is a melding. There's a mesh that some of the pageant girls are now paying more attention to the queerdo weird girls. And the queer scene's becoming more accepting of, like, understanding, like, wait, these pageant girls don't hate us. Like, it was just a whole mindset thing. And there are some queens that are, like, crossing over, and it's usually the beach scene versus the mainland. And now it is. And you see a crisscross, and it's really cool to watch, like, the minds of these people change.
All right. It sounds like I need to do a whole nother show just about that. Okay.
We'll get there.
You know what, Peter, I wanted to ask you about, you've talked about admiring New York and Chicago improv and comedy groups. Describe your journey opening Villain Theater here in Miami. And is it about bringing that here or creating your own scene?
Well, when we started, it was just an acting class. And in August of 2015, we did our first show. We were very lucky to have some theater friends that were interested in taking the class, around 10 of us. We called ourselves the first Villains. And so we did the show, this opening, and we had no idea what it was going to be. Because we were inspired by New York and Chicago and what they did with their improv scene. So UCB in New York, or the IO in Chicago, or Second City in Chicago. And so they were able to kind of build this community of actors and improv performers. And when we started doing it here, it became its own thing. We are interested now in how we can be different. We've already been able to have so much success. We've had almost 600 students in 2.5 years, and our company is around 60 people strong right now.
In just a couple of years.
Right, yeah. And it's going to be 3 years in August. And really, that's been, you know, kind of not a surprise. No, it has been a surprise. It's filling a void. It's been that we built this thing, and people were so excited about it. They kept coming, and then they saw the shows. We've been working so hard on them, and they appreciate them, and it keeps growing.
Is the goal to create that kind of scene where people, you know, because they'll think New York and Chicago.
Sure.
But is it about building a scene where people eventually say, oh, well, you got to see what they're doing in Miami. If you're not there, then that's the place to be.
Well, yeah, I hope so. I mean, that's a great aspiration. But I think Miami, with its own diversity, we already offer something completely different. Like in New York and Chicago, especially in their comedy scenes, they fight to have diversity with different races, something that's very natural at Villain Theater. Also, we are not just an LGBT theater, we're also a feminist theater. And we make sure that our performers are women are represented, and not just in the performers, but in the management. Janella Santos, who is our COO and runs the show for us at Villain, is an incredibly important part of what we do. So what we're doing here, I feel like we're already starting at a better foot than New York and Chicago did, which are kind of boys clubs and are looking for the diversity. And now it's just seeing how big we can make this thing.
Josh, just briefly in the short time that I have, 30 seconds, if you could just tell me, because you sort of touched on it a little while ago, is I wanted to get a sense of what the scene is here. And for the LGBTQ community, it seems like it's growing. But, I mean, you know, really for you, what else does it need?
So this show is actually going to be also a coming out party, essentially, for all queer performers, because it's not just going to be improv comics. We also have four comedians that are going to be doing sets that are all queer identifying. We're going to have monologists that are going to be telling some funny stories. And it's really is going to be a shining a light and saying, this is a huge thing that you have underground, and it's time for all of the performers to now come out in the light.
And again, I'm doing this right. Yas, LGBTQ improv team.
Yes.
See, by the end of the day, I got it right. Again, part of the Villain Theater. It's part of the No Fear We're Queer Comedy Night that's coming up. We're going to have more information on our website. I just want to thank the guests who are joining us, Peter Min, Josh Hamilton, and also Ms. Toto. Thank you so much, all of you, for
Thanks
being
so
here.
Thank you.
That's the program for today. Thank you so much. I'm Luis Hernandez. Talk to you tomorrow.